This is Kate Harness with 307 Net Info, and today I'm joined again by Superintendent Charles Oskey of Johnson County School District. Good morning, Charles.
Good morning. How's it going?
Well, it's good. I'm not very keen on the rain. I know many other people in our county are, but I'm not very keen on it, and so I feel a little gloomy. But we're going to have an interesting conversation, I know. So one thing that I did want to particularly ask you is about ESSER funding. It's spelled E-S-S-E-R, and it's a and so on, but what it really is it's some designated federal funds that came as a result of the pandemic to help the education system basically address some of the difficulties that had come along with that. And it was a huge sum of money, about $13.2 billion that Congress set aside and spread across the nation, and Johnson County School District received some of that money. But it also came with an expiration date of September 24, which is approaching fast. So, Charles, how much money was this windfall, because it was a bit of a windfall for Johnson County School District, how much money did we receive?
So to be clear, there's CARES, there's ESSER 1, there's ESSER 2, there's ESSER 3, and the one we're talking about, all of those grants have closed already. So ESSER 3, we're starting to wrap up, which you're correct, is basically September, or I call it the fall of 24. So we have to have everything accounted for by September and all spent by December. So the process is here. We're wrapping it up. It's about $3.6 million over the course since this was provided. But I'm not going to go into the weeds, but you have CARES. You've been referenced as ARP. You have ESSER 1, 2, or 3. There's been lots of grants, not just ESSER, that have come because of COVID, and they're funneled from the federal government, like you said, through the state, and then they're distributed through an amazing software program called Grant Management Systems, which the state is in the process of revamping. So anyway, it's a flow model through the state, which has to be approved through what's called Grant Management System, or I reference it all the time as GMS. But we are coming to an end with ESSER 3 funds, and I'm not gonna lie to you. In a situation that I'm excited, it's coming to an end because of the accountability that comes with these funds. They're public funds, and how they were spent. Part of that process was back in 2020, prior to me even being in this position, but being in another superintendent's position. There were deadlines, so a lot of districts around the state spent money because you had deadlines, and then the rules changed. So after the money was spent, then the rules changed. And so that's really what the complication. You've heard me say a lot of time there's cables tied to grants. Well, those cables are audits. So as we begin what we call the federal ESSER auditing seasons, which, you know, people say it's going to take the next 2 to 3 years to go through audits and federal audits and how the funds was spent, we've already started to see that. So ESSER funding is not just the end of it, but it's the auditing to make sure that districts use them according to the rules, but transparency to the public is a lot of money was spent nationwide, and then the rules were created. So there's going to be some things that pop up through these audits. Where do I feel Johnson County School District is? We had a growth opportunity in JCSD number one. When I first got here after COVID, people are aware we had a federal investigation based on the spending of COVID funds, which triggered the investigation of all federal programs all the way back to 2016. So I put a halt on ESSER 3 funding at that point in time until we really knew. Overall summary for that is as we grew, we changed our procurement policies, we changed our procedures, a lot of things that had been in place for a long time. We've kind of upped the ante with that. We did a lot of training, but with that halt, it gave us an opportunity to really see what the intent of the ESSER funds were for. And the intent was to sustain a district after COVID because there was an impact financially and keeping the operations and trying to keep the impact as negative or least impact on students, so districts continue. And that was part of what our intention was we ended up using the rest of the ESSER funding to kind of sustain. We were down 160 kids without you know, doing a huge reduction in staff, getting ourselves financially when we have $20 million worth of facility projects, and our depreciation reserves were a little about $300,000 when we need to have them at about $2 million. So we're kind of trying to sustain a sustainable budget. Everybody remembers or should, but I'll repeat, I mean, after my first year, it was evident we were $1.3 million short, a shortfall with funding with our general budget. Last year, we dropped that to $800,000, and this year, with the budget that was proposed budget, we're about $200,000. So we've been able to kind of sustain and bring our budgets to where we are, cleaning it up with a new software. And some of that is what the ESSER funds brought in, is the ability to really evaluate what systems need to be changed, creating financial, or not, contributing to infrastructure that allows us to make sure the dollars are going to the kids in the classroom and making some good decisions. So long-term planning is the new approach. It's, you heard me say last night in the board meeting, instead of being reactive, we want to be proactive and looking at where we're headed. The community itself has changed, the climate, as there's not a lot of young families. There's a lot of retirees and different things in the community, which we know is an impact. But I'm excited about where we're at. Am I nervous? Absolutely. There's 48 superintendents in the state of Wyoming that are going, oh, the audits are beginning, right? But I can with confidence say that we've learned a lot through this process and where we're at. And ESSER funds do end, you are correct, this year. But also in addition to that, if you heard me at the board meeting last night say, it's not just ESSER funds. Our other annual federal funds, which is Title I, Title II, and Title IV, I'll specifically speak to, we are projected to be about $80,000 less next year, just with federal funds in themselves, which has an impact. That's a lot of money because we were relying on those. So we have to look at what programs do we absolutely need and what programs don't need. So those are things those are challenges that we face in the future.
The money that ESSER provided, what was it spent on?
So a lot of it was spent on professional development. We put teachers in some classrooms. We put those back into that. We brought it back to that infrastructure piece of some of our software, some of our planning, front lines, evaluation pieces, and just maintaining a budget so we could keep the staff that we have. I mean, I want to be very clear. It was to not reduce staffing or opportunities. We actually added some people because there was some true bubbles, that there were some struggles that we needed to focus on intentional with kids. But just maintaining daily operations, that's the very last one, is maintaining, trying to maintain a current budget where people stay employed so we're not laying a lot of people off, and maintain that educational platform. So that's the best summary of that. Did we go on? We brought national trainers here, so that PLC, so that national... The professional learning communities. You know what? We trained over 90 staff members. That's where some of that comes. Our summer school has been paid out of that. There's just been a lot of things that, since I've been here, the intention is to bring the trainers here, not send a lot of people out to different things when we can. So a lot of it's been based around PD and that infrastructure, and that targeted goal of me is becoming, we train the trainers. So that mentality of when the money goes away, we want to be able to have the capability, you've heard me say multiple times, doing cross-training. So what are we doing with federal grants? Well, when I first got here, this is just an example, only one person knew about federal grants and what to go through that, and that happened to be me, because everybody, the one person had been gone. Now there's five or six people that are very comfortable with how we operate the federal grants. So a lot of cross-training, but I would say maintaining a district infrastructure and a lot of professional development is where that money has gone.
The obvious next question is, how hard is going to be the impact of not having those monies? you've always known that they were going to expire, that, you know, there was a stepping off point. How prepared is that within the school district so that it feels seamless?
I think that's one thing that, no, not think, I know that's one thing that I'm excited about is we didn't put a lot of funds into something that's non-sustainable. We put funds into things, for example, like our software and our transition to that. That's not going away. So it's already there. It's part of our budget, but it helped get it implemented. That PD piece is still going to continue. What's it going to be? That means we're just going to have to speak a little bit harder about what is necessary and what's not. We've been able to push teachers back into the general budget. That's part of what that initiative is. But it won't be as hard as some districts have to, because I think their salaries were based on ESSER funds. Ours are not. We've been kind of niching things up a little bit. So you hear that piece. We've been able to maintain our class sizes. They are fairly low compared to most districts. When we're competing with $53,000 base and their class sizes are 25 to 26, it's different. So again, ESSER funds have given us an opportunity to really evaluate what we need and what we don't need. So I don't think that transition is going to be as hard as it should be, or could be, not should be, could be. So again, the journey, I mean, let's be real. $1.9 million we owed the state 12 months ago today. Okay, that was changed. That was something that was unpredicted that happened because of legislative change, which required then for us, because of cash revenue flows. I mean, it wasn't just COVID. I mean, these are all the things that have been impacted from COVID. Even though people say, well, it's a long time ago, these are still the impacts, our economy and what we're doing. But with that simple change, because the State Department got in trouble with how special ed funds were being allocated to districts, they had to change their protocol. And when that protocol changed, they took special education out. We became a recapture district, which meant we needed to pay money back, which we really didn't, but just rules. So 1.9 million, then we had to get a loan for 3.6 million. And then we had to pay all that back over 12 months. So when people say, how did you use funds? We used it knowing that we had a 30 to 40% revenue flow in the negative most of the year, is to maintain our current infrastructure so that we could make payroll on a monthly basis, pay our light bills, all that. So when people say COVID's over, yeah, but we're still feeling the impact with our economy and what we're seeing in society and the cost of living and all that. So maintaining, which is the ultimate goal of ESSER funds, was to make sure that we maintain a quality education across the board. So a huge celebration is not only coming back to a budget of only $200,000, which is manageable from $1.3 million, but if you add the amount of money we had to pay back to the state, which is a smoke and mirrors because they really owed us, but you had to pay it back, but it, you know, you don't have it in your bank. You take 1.9 and whatever the 3.6, that's over $5 million, close to $6 million that there's been a cash flow back and forth. So we are really trying to use the money, have used, not trying. We are using the money to make sure that our district stays afloat and that we can keep the current infrastructure, which we know is good for kids. And we're also not the only show in town now. We've talked about this with homeschooling, private schools, virtual schools. It's just that revamp. So a lot of that, some of our ESSER funds is done towards professional development training. ESSER funds will be used for this rebrand. ESSER funds were used to help support strategic planning. So all of those things are long-term projects that this money was used that will impact this district for a long time.
You describe a payback required to the state. Some people may be astonished to hear that the very entity that actually funds you wanted money back. Can you just explain that a little more?
Yeah. So there's numbers that are projected in a 100 on what you receive for a budget. So just for example, the $1.9 million that we were supposed to return was because they say that they overpaid us. But the reality is just how the process works. it was kind of silly in my mind. We had to pay by July 1st, but in August we were going to get money back from the state because they really owed us money, right? So it's systems and processes that need to change, and we've been very proactive with that. Well, then after that, because at that point in time we were considered a recapture, in order we don't get any monthly payments from the state. Okay, so people think just because we qualify, no, think it's a misperception. That's all it is. Just because our budget and the state guarantees us, and I'm just going to use some round numbers for simple math. Just because the state says you get $20 million, they don't write me a check for $20 million on July 1st. So then I don't have $20 million in my bank account that I'm just going. They don't actually start paying us until August. So really, the revenue flow is kind of like a rancher. You get a one-time check, and then you got to balance it. Well, ours is a little more complicated. We know what we're supposed to get, but a lot of that depends on what revenue comes in locally, and then the state determines what they're going to pay us. So it's all estimates. It is an estimate of what we do. Well, if our estimates are off because somebody didn't pay their taxes or the mineral industry didn't pay this, then we then have to scramble to make sure our monthly is done. So revenue flow really doesn't start in Johnson County. Half a payment in August, which is very little compared to October. So really you got June, half a payment in May, nothing in June, nothing in July, half in August, and then you finally getting stabilized with revenue after August. Really means that we've got 4 months there that we've got to really financially plan for to make sure we have the revenues to make sure we keep our buildings up and running. And August is huge for us. PD, teachers are coming in, students are starting, so that revenue flow, all of our summer projects. I mean, we got millions of dollars worth of summer projects that we have to pay out over the summer, and that cash revenue flow there. So it's not a steady flow from the state. There's processes in place. So we had to get a loan to make sure that we could make payments, monthly payments, and then they're predicting that we're going to get this huge check from the local revenues and be able to pay it back in December. Well, that's not what happens. We did not, because state statute and laws changed 2 years ago with how they collect taxes. So prior to this, December used to be a big month. So we could pay the loan back. Well, that's when the loan was supposed to be paid back. Well, it's not. It's every month now. So, again, that's a four-hour conversation. I just muddied the water with...
It sounds incredibly complicated and requires tremendous amount of oversight and expertise, just being able to juggle what is essentially red tape.
It is. So I apologize. But it's a very intense conversation. But here's the reality of what I'm going to summarize. Revenue flow compared to if we got a $20 million budget doesn't mean that we got $20 million. It's about how we get the cash. It's a combination of local revenues and state revenue, and how they pay us monthly has to balance out with what our monthly expenditures are. And that includes salaries and benefits and just the everyday operations of our building. So,
you mentioned some of the impacts of COVID, and one of the impacts that I think everybody still feels, regardless of your professional area of work, is that the working world does just not seem to be the same as it was before. And there appear to be less people who are willing to work. There are less people coming into the teaching profession. We've had conversations about that.
Yes.
We're at the very end of our school year, and teachers are thinking about what they are going to be doing next year. What is our staff turnover like now? You've had, I would imagine that the vast majority, the proportion of people who say, right, it's time for me to move on, or I'm going to stop doing this. What has it been like this year?
So I think it's pretty typical if you really look at it. If you look at our board agenda last night, that was a question, but some of it's activity turnover, it's transferring from building to building, and it's about choices. But you and I had this conversation. It's not just public school, and I appreciate you reminding it. It is in every industry. But the status that, a quote, did you know, that I put in my board report, over 30% of first-year teachers quit after the first year. And now the new stat is over 50% of new teachers are out of the business in the first 5 years. So
that's a nationwide.
That's a nationwide.
And I think that we believe here in Wyoming that we are different. And that in Johnson County, we are different again, that we are a closer, tighter, more committed community. Is that what you are seeing in terms of our staff turnover, do you think? Or do you think that
our trend is headed that way. Because Wyoming is traditionally always 3 or 4 years behind the national trend. However, I have to look and be proactive in saying, we got some amazing master teachers. If you look at our salary schedule and where we're at, we have a majority of teachers that are on the upper side of the salary schedule, which means they've been veterans. They've been here for a long time. So that retention of them is critical also. But we also got to start planning as a district. So what about the new generation coming in? What does this look like? How do we get systems in place? Again, that's what the ESSER funds tried to do with the new teacher induction, which we're still trying to grow into a place where do you bring teachers in? How do you mentor them? What does that look like in that program piece? So when we make these statements, is right now, absolutely, Wyoming is very traditional, and the fact is we have a lot of committed great teachers that are here that are long term. How do you keep them? But we got to be realistic and say most of them are not going to teach till the age of 90. All right, they're getting close to retirement. They put a lot of time and commitment in. What are we going to do to maintain, knowing that those stats of new people coming in? So if other districts are struggling with that, that means the population, we've got to get some good people here that want to stay here in that process. So looking at how do we get them here to start? Sure. But more importantly, it's how do we keep them here? And some of that is the pressures that are put on teachers now. It's not about just the funding, how much they get paid. A lot of it is about people understanding this is a great community. You know, a majority of people really take pride in Johnson County, all right? Whether it's KC, whether it's Buffalo, people believe in that. Well, you got to get people to come in and say, wow, people here love the schools, all right? It's not about the money. It's about the community support. It's about you get to look out and you get to look at the mountains on some days. Whether it's raining or whether it's snowing, we do have some blessings that most people don't have. So really promoting our class sizes. I have no colleagues in other districts that have 50 kids in a class. We're not there. I mean, that it's about a quality of education. So that rebrand is really saying, hey, look what our community does. It is about family. There's a lot of great things here. So it's just a rebrand a little bit to remind people, This is a pretty amazing place to be.
There are pros and cons to having been in any profession for a long period of time. And you mentioned we have a lot of master teachers. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're old, but you know they may just be very well qualified. But if you have a...
You are correct.
A large proportion of your staff who are close to aging out... there are two questions that arise. One is everything already in place to attract new teachers? They don't necessarily have to be first brand new teachers, but have you got things in place to attract them? And as you say, it's not just salary, and we have had separate conversations about housing and those issues too, and this is probably not the moment to go into that. But then there's also the issue of, you know, having an older or longer term staff body, which is that, you know, are they tired? Are they just coasting? Are they just getting to the end of, you know, getting to the point that they can get their retirement? And what do you do to retain them as vibrant and meaningful staff?
Well, the answer to two of those questions are this. Things are getting put in place to how do we get people here? And then how do we maintain that? Some of the greatest resources we have to teach teachers are master teachers, are veteran teachers. That's professional learning communities. That's what that about is, that collaboration with somebody who's been in the business. It's nothing against the universities. It's nothing against what we do or how we've gone through it. Universities are doing the best they can to prepare. But the reality, there is a lot of experience, a lot of knowledge that comes with 20-some-plus years of education, right? You know, we hear, well, teachers just coast. Well, that's part of a process of accountability. But one or two people, if there's that perception coasting, we got eight people that are just have a passion that come for kids every day. Well, that passion and that knowledge that they, whether you call them the sensei of education, the master of what we're doing, we just use different terms however you want to relate that. But that knowledge of experience cannot be replaced with a textbook in theory. This is what works. This is what not works. We know that there's research, you know, evidence-based. We always hear that in education. Well, is it evidence-based? Is it research-based? Absolutely. Years of experience in the classroom, and you have a high-performing class every time with a master teacher, there's evidence around that just with the experience, how you build relationships with kids. The research is starting to show it's not about what's in the textbook. It's about the teacher and the relationship and the expectations of what comes across that. And it's hard work. I mean, let's be real. It's every day. You got to be on your A game. We are all human. There's this perception that teachers are like Superman or, you know, Wonder Woman. They're just every day they're on their A game, which they come with that intention, but we've got to realize they are just as human as the rest of us. So good days, bad days. I talk a lot about how do we support each other in this process, but getting professional learning communities and the intention of going on a side trail here, the intention of getting intentional collaboration with our veteran teachers, with people coming in, is what's going to make that long-term sustainability, and not necessarily about money, because there is some research that does show that most people stay in the business because of they feel they're valued and they feel they're supported. And those are all things that we have to try to create, intentionally create. And that starts from me, but it also has to be very intentional from my building leadership and my supervisors. Their culture within their building, it's not about each one of us rowing in a different direction. We all got to row in the right direction, but it's kind of that communication piece, which we talked a little bit about, is how do we get this down through our entire system, but then how do we get that out to our community?
I'm sure this is an issue that we will revisit again, and I look forward to that conversation. Before we wrap up, I'd just like to switch gears quickly. The repeal of gun-free zones in schools has been a legislative topic. In fact, it did pass through our legislature, but our governor vetoed it. Yes. For various reasons that you can go and find out for yourself. But the issue, that does not mean that the issue has gone away. And it is expected to come back at the next session. And indeed, it may well be a platform for some candidates seeking office at the state level. Where are things within Johnson County? And do we have an opinion about this? What happens next? It came up at yesterday's board meeting.
Absolutely it did. So thank you for bringing this topic so we can educate people as we go through. It is. It's reality. And so the key word is where are we at as a district and what do our stakeholders? It's not what Charles believes, but what our community is. So my intention last night of bringing it to the board and bringing it to the community is so everybody knows where we stand, where I stand as a superintendent, that the reality is this is coming back and it will pass. We can be proactive and say this is what we want as a community. Our voice is heard because right now a lot of people are speaking for us as school districts when we just need to have the facts and say this is what our community wants, this is what our school district has in place to kind of meet why this bill is being passed. So we will be out and looking for feedback because we want to be in control. There's a lot of concerns, well, we'll do all this work and then legislation will tell us what to do. No. If I'm going to go to the table and say this is what we're doing as a school district, this is what we believe in, that puts out the myths that everybody in Johnson County believes in this. So we're going to be proactive, start asking people what the pros and cons are. As I mentioned last night, is we really need to start with that collaborative piece with law enforcement, with our insurance company, our administrators, and our district attorney, what are all the legal ramifications behind what was passed that got vetoed, so we understand that, so we truly understand what the intention was. And then we have to ask our community, what do we really want? What is important to us? How do we want this to look in our district? So it comes back to us being in control, which is going to be based not on Charles's personal beliefs. It's going to be based on what does this community want and what do they perceive. So it's going to be education and feedback.
But if legislation is passed as it is anticipated to at some point, mm-hmm. may not be the next session, maybe thereafter, but it is expected to pass, as you say, that the gun-free zones will be repealed. Are you saying that each individual school district can in some way create its own policy about?
That's what everybody was, the districts need to be in control and not be told of what districts want.
But how does it work if you have a legal right to take a gun into a school zone? You can't at the moment, but if you could do that, how can the school district supersede that legal authority?
I think the question comes in, do we as community want people in our schools with guns? So we need to get that feedback of what does a community really want? Is this just, the loud voices? We need to say, okay, so what are the ramifications if we have concealed weapons in the schools? Where are the scenarios? Where are we not trained when we're dealing with people that have concealed weapons? So more of my approach is I really want to know what the community feels about that, and then we as a school have to decide what are our capabilities and not capabilities, and what are our concerns, and how are we going to approach them. You're right, legislation is going to tell us anybody can come in, but then what are the ramifications? So a parent meeting, who's coming in, how do you address people, how does law enforcement come in and address people, all those things. It sounds good. But the reality is we got to start asking the details. What does this really mean for us, and how does this impact us, so we can have that conversation with legislators?
And I know from separate conversations with our police chief and sheriff that they're concerned about there being armed individuals, especially in an active shooter situation, because it can make things very complicated for their response. It may be all with very good intentions, but the reality of how that then plays out may actually not be good.
I'll speak some things as an educator. So how do I address a meeting where it gets heated and somebody has we come in to have a conversation and somebody's agitated or upset? So when and how do we have meetings when a community member comes in and they're agitated and obviously have a concealed weapon? So that approaches things. It's going to make the teaching profession even harder. Knowing that sometimes there are concerns about what we're doing and at what level, how do you handle those situations when somebody is agitated, when somebody comes in. The whole idea that our focus is what we've tried to do with schools and our security system that we just approved, our locked doors, our camera systems, our check-in, check-outs, what we know what's happening within our buildings. We put a lot of time and effort in to make sure our kids are protected and we're monitoring our schools. So everything that we've done up to this point all needs to be re-looked at. Why are we putting money into these security systems to manage people? Comes back to that. We got to start having that conversation about what does this really do to public schools? And I have to focus on public schools because it's not just schools. It's going to affect a lot of people. It's going to affect the hospitals, the city government, the county, all of these different places where we're supposed to stay out of it. They're going to all have to come to the table too and decide what does this look like and how do we not support, how do we navigate what this looks like?
So a quick question before we wrap up. I know that we're out of time and you need to go and do something else, but what is going to be the process? How does the community, if somebody's listening to this and they want their voice heard, what is the process?
I will wrap my head around that, because the first thing we're going to start out was meeting with people that what questions do we need to go out, and then we'll just probably have some public meetings, and more importantly we'll send some surveys out. I know people cringe when Charles says survey comes out, but the only way we can really reach the community in fairness is to understand this is not a Charles directive. This is understanding we've got to look down the road to where it is. I understand and I respect everybody has their personal belief about this. I mean, there are people that are totally support this and there's people that totally don't support this. We've got to find what we want as a majority of the community. And let me come back. A majority of the community feels is best for our community as we approach this. So we might even have to talk with the city and the county and the hospital. So that's the other thing people don't look at. The hospital can't have one set of expectations and how they're handling it, and then the district, and then everybody else. This is huge. Because we've seen it in COVID. Everybody had their different protocols for each different facility. And then, well, they do this, we do that. I mean, it's not just simple as giving a survey. There's going to have to be some leadership within the community that we all talk about what do we really want in Johnson County.
A massive topic, which I'm sure we will revisit several times as it plays out. Charles, thank you very much.
Can I end with one other thing?
Please do.
I want everybody to be reminded that this is a topic that's going to take a lot of time and effort, but our number one focus is still educating kids.
Thank you very much. And Charles, I'm sure we will talk again before the end of the school year, but we're on the eve of it. So the last little stretch to the end of the race. So,
oh my gosh, there's so many exciting things. And I appreciate our conversations.
So thank you, as do I.
Yep, thank you.